Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. This is Jonathan Tuckett speaking once again after a long hiatus. It's been a while since you've heard my voice, actually, now that I think about it. Today we're out on the mound in Edinburgh at the Wash Pub, and I have with me Chris and David.
Hello.
Hi.
They are both drinking IPA, whereas I have my charming glass of Coke with me.
Ubiquitous.
Yes.
Yeah, glass of Coke, yeah.
I'd like to say the Coke is sponsored by the BASR, but it's not.
No.
It's sponsored by David this time around.
Yeah, I bought it.
But yes, now that I've mentioned the BASR, I would actually like to thank the BASR for all the other sponsorship that they do give us. We don't just spend their money on booze, we actually use it for useful things like getting
we never spend the money on booze.
Yes, that's categorically
This week, we draw our religion in a global context theme to a close with an interview with Peter Baer. And Chris is going to introduce that interview for us.
Yeah, that was very eloquently put there. Nice one. I've already made the joke twice now, and I'm going to make it again.
That Peter Baer literally wrote the book on globalisation.
But it's true.
It's great.
So I was delighted to get to record this interview with him in Ottawa at the end of November. We introduce, as we go throughout the interview, the whole concept of globalization and what looking at religion through this globalization lens, what new insights that can give us. I don't want to say too much about it because it's all contained there within the interview. So for now, I think we'll just literally pass you over to me in Ottawa, chatting with Peter Baer. Today I am joined by Professor Peter Baer of the University of Ottawa. We're recording in Ottawa today. We're going to be talking about the large topic of religion and globalisation, although Peter shall hopefully be bringing in a lot of Canadian examples from his recent work. Peter is the author of Religion in Global Society and a co-editor of Globalization, Religion and Culture, and also has another book coming out soon called Growing Up Canadian, from some research with Canadian immigrant youth that we'll be discussing during the interview. So first off, Professor Baer, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you.
So we've already been having quite a stimulating discussion, and I'm hoping that we can maybe replicate some of that for the recording. That was my bad. But let's just start off with globalization. I know we could talk all day about globalization, but for our listeners who may not know just what the basic concept is.
I like all the basic concepts, but it's controverted. But I'll just briefly say what I mean by it.
Yeah.
And what I insist that it dominantly mean, by starting what it doesn't dominantly mean, is not just neoliberal capitalism in the contemporary era. Globalization. I still like Roland Robertson's phrase. It's the world becoming a single place. And that includes the awareness of it being a single place. My own take on it is basically to treat the entire social world as one single society.
Right.
Even though it's still quite meaningful to talk about regional societies, national societies, things like that. But it's quite clear that for some time now, the world has been a single place in the sense that interaction, communication, contact has been worldwide for quite some time. And that means that globalization isn't something particularly recent, although it has recent phases. It probably started at the dawn of human history, you know, the process. When does globalization start, I think, is a question of, you know, what's the purpose of asking that question.
Yeah.
And for all intents and purposes, most of us, including myself, start the discussion somewhere in the European Middle Ages, but it could start before that. I mean, we think of, for instance, the foundation of Islam back in the 7th century of the Common Era. That was a huge process, a globalizing process.
Definitely.
Quick order did not compass the entire world, but, you know, probably half of it. So there's all sorts of antecedents to this. We're going to talk about the Chinese Empire, we're going to talk about the Roman Empire and the Mediterranean empires and things like that. There are antecedent processes. But for all intents and purposes, you start with the European Middle Ages because that, with hindsight, was the developments in the process that eventually made it truly global. So that, for good or for ill, we're now all in the same place. And for many people, of course, it's not a great advantage, but there we have it. My own sub-concern about all that is to talk about the relationship between what we call religion and this globalization. And there, I suppose my main theme is that religion is not something that responds to globalization, that is affected by globalization, that religion is and always has been an intimate part of the process since the beginning. One merely has to think of Karl Jaspers' axial age thesis, where the kinds of phenomena that he zeroes in on, which took place, you know, say, 2,800 to 2,000 years ago, plus or minus a few centuries, you know, depending on how you want to look at it, that these processes had everything to do with what we now understand as religion, and indeed with what we have the habit of calling world religions. So that by way of saying that religion is not something that's sort of sitting there and then all of a sudden globalization came along and whacked it in the back of the head. It is itself a manifestation of what I understand as globalization. And the 2006 book was supposed to be my final attempt to say what I meant by that. But as so often happens in academic careers, you can't get away from your antecedents. You get stuck with a certain kind of area of discourse, shall we say.
And sorry for perpetuating that today.
Yeah, and in my case, it's not that people necessarily. I mean, part of it is that people forever asking you, could you come and talk to us about religion and globalization, right? Since you got your name attached to this, and of course, to a certain degree, I like doing that. It all depends on with whom and where. But the other part of it is that it's something that pops up in my head. With the religion and globalization discussion, although I thought that religions and global society of 2006 was certainly not the last word, but the last big word I was going to contribute to it, I ended up being wrong about that because I've gotten back into it in a different way. And that kind of started... It started in a conference of the International Sociology for the Sociology of Religion in 2003, which took place in Torino, Italy. And there I felt a little playful, and so I thought, well, if everyone was abandoning the secularization thesis, like rats deserting a sinking ship, and I found that to be very peculiar. So I set myself the task of, well, if we're not talking about secularization anymore, what are we going to talk about? You know, what's going to take its place, if anything? Kind of a paradigm shifty kind of thing. That effort, the paper I delivered at that conference 2003 was wholly unsatisfactory. But thereafter, I kind of developed it a little further and did a little syllogism, first, globalization is also a concept that it's the word for what we're all in, right? It's a totalizing word. Everybody, you know, you haven't got a choice. You live in global society, right? And therefore, globalization is something, is an isation word. It's something that's happening to all of us. The closest word within the disciplines in which I work that used to occupy that place was modernization. Mm-hmm. In fact, the entire discipline of sociology was obsessed and structured around the distinction between the modern and the traditional. Modernization, as a parallel term, took on some peculiar directions as secularization was being abandoned. It was being pluralized. Yeah. You know, not just Shmuel Eisenstadt, but a lot of people were talking about plural modernities. Right? So it wasn't the overarching term anymore. And so the hypothesis was, well, it looks like globalization in some senses has replaced modernization, and the two are related, but they're not the same, they don't mean the same thing. And so I tried to set up a little syllogism. If secularization was what happened, was the way to talk about religion in a context when modernization, modernity, was the dominant overarching concept, what replaces it when globalization is the dominant overarching concept? And without going through the entire logic of it, I came up with the idea of pluralization, which... You know, to some degree. I mean, I published a couple of articles basically trying to defend this thesis. And I still think there's something to it. Because it seems that now we're possessed with religion being everywhere in every shape, size, description, and like it's just popping out of the woodwork, and isn't this interesting? And so I tried to do an argument about, you know, how globalization logically leads to a view of religion which emphasizes its plurality.
Yeah.
And indeed, after everything was global, it seems that in the last half decade to a decade, everything's diverse, right? So it seemed like the academic world around me was confirming my idea that we used to talk about, you know, the global, and now we're talking about religious diversity, cultural diversity, and all these kinds of things. So that was the beginning part, and then the next part was that I was really kind of troubled, shall we say, by other attempts to talk about this using post-language.
Mm-hmm.
Not post-modernism anymore, or only.
So now post-modern.
Post-post, yes. But you know, post is a prefix that we put on things when we don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because we know what it isn't, but we don't know what it is. So we say post. And one of the post words that I was particularly struck with was the idea of post-secular, which a number of people, not just Jürgen Habermas, were actually publishing about. And it occurred to me that although the secularization thesis seems to have been abandoned by most sociologists of religion in a relatively short order, by short order, I mean, you know, space of about 20 years,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't appear to me as if the world has really changed all that much. What has changed is that a lot of people who used to insist on thinking of the world as Western Europe and North America now, quite in the context of globalization, clearly realize that there's a bigger world out there. And if you look at that world, things don't seem to be quite so uniformly secular. But that doesn't mean that all that other stuff to which people used to point has changed all that much. And then there's the question, are we living in a time of desecularization, religious resurgence, and things like that? So it's in response to this idea that post-secular seems to be unsatisfactory, and yet the idea of pluralization also only seems to be get at part of it. So I'm trying to develop a new direction where I commit the same sin as everyone else and use a post-word, but I've decided to use my own post-word, ripping it off from the political scientists and talking about post-Westphalianism. Clearly, in a half-hour interview, I'm not going to talk about what that is.
But if you just quickly say, like, Westphalia, was, you know, the Treaty of Westphalia.
Well, yeah, it refers to the 1648 Peace of Westphalia, yeah. Which was one of those moments in which the Europeans solved a particularly difficult and violent problem in their own sphere of killing themselves for each other for 100 years in the name of religion, or at least so it seemed, when everybody knew that religion wasn't the only thing involved. So Westphalia solved, quote-unquote, the problem by saying, we realize that a society has to have a single religion, but we don't have a situation where we can enforce that, so let's all just divide everything up into sovereign states. And within the sovereign state, the sovereign is sovereign, and therefore can decide what religion reigns. Problem solved. So you get this rough, very rough isomorphism between religious identity and national identity that eventually develops, which has had a huge effect on how we conceive and structure religion in roughly parallel lines. In other words, the world divided into nation states is very roughly parallel to the religious world divided into religions. But that seems to be falling apart now. Hence post.
Yeah.
Right. And then the effort is, well, what do you mean by post? And then it was also an effort to find some way of talking about the abandonment of secularization, And the increasing talk about spirituality, spiritual revolutions, lived religion, and all these kinds of theses that have been coming very strong lately, and trying to think that as into a theoretical coherent whole. And that's a work in progress.
Hmm. Okay, so you've laid out your thought process in a sort of broad theoretical position, but perhaps if you could take us through how you actually apply this, because I don't know, we're talking sort of lofty concepts and sort of
cloud nine theory, yes.
Worldwide globalized concepts. So maybe if you could bring it into your recent work here in Canada.
Yeah. Well, the book that you mentioned at the beginning, which is called Growing Up Canadian, which will appear sometime in the first part of next year, is a book that reports a particular research project on 1.5 and second generation people from immigrant families in Canada, families that predominantly migrated after 1970. And that book focuses on people from three religious backgrounds, Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist. Its purpose was to, its question was, how are the people of this generation or these generations relating to the religions of their heritage? Now, in terms of the larger theoretical impulse, my motivation for this was to phrase this in the term, how are these second generation people engaging in the reconstruction of their religious heritages for their Canadian context and in their lived personal lives?
Yeah.
It was kind of like a reconstruction of global religions in the Canadian context question, but applied to the second generation, because the second generation is that peculiar group of people who are both and.
Yeah.
They in some senses have a location in another part of the world, and yet they're solidly from here. In this case, here is Canada, and so they can best represent their replanting of particular religious traditions and their necessary reconstruction in so-called diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the kind of the research design idea behind examining these generations and looking at non-Christian religions initially. There's a second project which is still underway, which looks at Christianity and other religions we left out of that first project. That has dovetailed very, very nicely into the entire globalization of religion effort, at least from my perspective it has.
Yeah.
And specifically that probably the major empirical discovery or confirmation, if you like, of that first project, which is being reported in this book, is that the way the religions are being reconstructed is radically different depending on which religion you're talking about.
Right.
Religions don't behave the same way, even though there are a lot of similarities. And specifically, the way that Muslims reconstruct Islam in the Canadian context is very different from the way Hindus reconstruct Hinduism and Buddhists reconstruct Buddhism. So much so that if you use the criteria that are most enlightening for drawing conclusions about how the second generation was reconstructing Islam, if you used those criteria, there wouldn't be any apparent reconstruction on the part of the Hindus or Buddhists at all, right? But not because they're just irreligious, but because their relationship to their traditions is different, because the way those traditions, or religions, if you like, operate in the current global context is different.
I mean, I just want to jump in there with one, if you could give a real sort of tangible example of how they're constructing it differently, but also what does that say about us using this overarching category of religion if things are playing out so differently on the ground, that you could really talk about them as the same phenomenon?
It's this discussion that we've been having in religious studies and the sociology of religion to some extent for a long, long time,
yeah.
Is that there is something highly artificial about this whole idea of world religions. But they're there. right? It's, you know, you can say, well, look, this is all kind of started with Christianity. It's all in a Christian model and all these kind of, true. It has lots to do with Western imperialism, you know, lording it over the rest of the world. Of course it does. But we have arrived where we arrived, and the Muslims, reconstruct Islam differently than Hindus reconstruct Hinduism and Buddhism. But everybody's operating as if these things self-evidently exist, right? There's no question about that among the people who are supposedly carrying these traditions. Hmm. Now, to give you an idea of the difference, I mean, it's a fairly obvious difference. Muslims, at least these Muslims in Canada, center their reconstruction around what I think it was Olivier Roy called global Islam, what I call the five-pillar model. It's a very consistent narrative about what constitutes Islam, and it centers around the five pillars and certain belief structures, Quran-centered, Hadith-centered, those kinds of things that we've become so used to. But it's not the only way to do Islam, historically. There's virtually no Sufism in these people. And Sufism is still alive and well in many parts of the world. So it's almost like these people know the story and they subscribe to it, whether they consider themselves to be part of it or not. Even the non-religious Muslims recognize Islam as being what the religious Muslims said it was, right? Except they said, that's not me. Right? Now, the Hindus, by contrast, and this is also not at all surprising, recognized Hinduism as religion, but drew very fuzzy lines between the religious and the cultural aspects of their identity. So much so that a large number of them would maintain aspects of the religious tradition even though they themselves didn't believe it.
Yeah.
Right? We do this because we're Hindu, and I like doing this. It's part of family, it's part of culture. But I don't really care whether the gods and goddesses actually exist. Or I don't do that part of it, but I like the dance, right? And especially the food. So you got this kind of melding of what the categories of what they and us you call religion and culture. And yet there's a clear Hindu entity there, which has no center like the Muslims do. But what we know about contemporary Hinduism, so-called, is that it does not have a center. Mm-hmm. And the only way that you can create a center, as I tried to argue in the 2006 book, is by sitting down and theologizing about it, which people do. Yeah. Hindus do that. Our participants in this research, by and large, did not bother. Nor were they particularly attracted to any to politicized Hinduism, you know, Hindutva, Hindu nationalism, things like that, any more than the Muslims were particularly attracted to politicized or militant Islam. Mm. So there you have that difference. Now, the Buddhists are an entirely different category. One can basically say the Buddhists hardly knew anything about what we know as Buddhism at all. Many of them were East Asian and drew even a fuzzier line between religion and culture, but a very fuzzy line between Buddhism and that religious stuff which is not Buddhism. But they had also other kinds of attitudes. For instance, that whatever Buddhism was, it was very peaceful and nice, right? Buddhists don't hurt people, right? And well aware of the public image of Buddhism as being this peaceful, nice religion, very much associated with people like the Dalai Lama, and with no militant, nasty characters associated with it. And they also associated Buddhism very much with morality, with leading a moral life, which was kindness and, you know, compassion and all these kinds of things. An engaged Buddhism, if you like, was more close to what they were after, what they were doing. Or that they recognized no difference between Chinese culture, say, and culture, or what we call popular Chinese religion, tending to graves, you know, burning incense, yes, and all that kind of stuff. That was also for them Buddhism, so provided it had something to do with the ancestors or the dead. So very, very fuzzy. But if you look at that in terms of, are they reconstructing Buddhism the way the Muslims are constructing Islam, the answer is no. They're not contributing to that kind of reconstruction at all. But it doesn't mean it isn't going on, but they're not doing it. So you have three very different scenarios. Now, not in the book, the contemporary current research on whole different varieties of Christians has found another confirmation of this. And that is that you ask, well, do Christians reconstruct I mean, immigrant Christians from other parts of the world, do they construct Christianity in the Canadian context like the Muslims, more like the Hindus, more like the Buddhists? How is it going to be? Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is all of the above, depending on what kind of Christian you're talking about. Yeah. The most loose Christians in terms of Reconstruction are, strangely speaking, given their history, the Roman Catholics. Notoriously, the Eastern Christians hardly draw a distinction between culture and religion at all. Then you have the evangelicals. And the evangelicals have a script that they follow. When I read their interviews, I almost say, you're reading from the same book, aren't you?
Yeah.
Right? It's so consistent.
Literally.
Even when they show evidence of actually not acting out and believing in their real lives what they're saying. Right, but they know what it is important and improper to say as Christians, as evangelical Christians. So, if you ask, you know, who's constructing their religion most like the Muslims, it's the evangelical Christians. We're not done with the Sikhs yet, but the Sikhs are somewhere in... Is Sikhism more like Islam, more like Hinduism, right? That old question. And the answer is both. Maybe something else too. We're not finished yet. So there's still more things to be said. Yeah. But this is all kind of in the context of global reconstruction, because this is going on all around the world, and it's going on differently depending on, well, first and second generation, for instance, their parents don't do it the way the children do it. We didn't examine the parents, but there's lots of literature on the parents, and they're not doing it quite that same way at all. So you know, their different social groups are, as it were, remaking their religions in different fashion, just like what's happening in Canada is somewhat similar to what's happening in Britain, but there's also some differences. And in the Growing Up Canadian book, I wrote a chapter on comparing as much as I could, given the literature, was Europe, United States, and Canada. I wanted to include Australia and New Zealand, but there's no literature on the second generation to speak of there yet. So that all by, you know, giving you a kind of very concrete example of how at least I have tried to use that theoretical stuff in some concrete research.
A specific question which my colleague David, who obviously isn't here, asked me to ask, which links quite well to what you've just been saying there. It was about theodicy, and when we have people constructing their religious identities in globalized contexts, what does that do to sort of concepts of the other? You know, is the if you're constantly surrounded by the other, he was suggesting, and I think he got this from reading some of your material, that you either end up with a sort of new age thing where the sort of evil other is sort of suppressed and everything is all good and lightness, or it's internalized. And he's looking at sort of conspiracy theories and sort of David Icke and reptilians and all that, so the evil being internalized. So in this context, we have these young people sort of reconstructing their identities in pluralized, globalized context. What are they doing with that sort of traditional concept of the other?
Well, they're doing two things with it. One is most of them are great fans of multiculturalism. Now, this is a la Canada, right? Yeah. Not the way Europeans tend to understand that word. We'll do it in Mira, you know, that kind of discussion that they've had. This just doesn't apply to Canada, right? In Canada, we actually believe this myth. And so do these people that we talk to. They're highly critical about it. It's just, they're basically saying multiculturalism is a great idea. I wish we'd put it into practice better, right? And part of that is multiculturalism is not people different living side by side. You know, religious identities different, cultural identities different, however you want to conceive that. There has to be mutual benefit and interaction. So multiculturalism is only working when people are changing in interaction and learning from each other. Mostly, and there are some exceptions, the attitudes of the people involved in these research projects were quite ironic and tolerant, shall we say. I know the problems with the word toleration, but in the sense that they were not likely to want to impose their religion on anyone else, thought it was great to have other religions around them, and if they were highly religious people, they might complain that Canadian society didn't take religion seriously enough, but certainly other religions weren't the problem.
Yeah.
And even other versions of our own religion. Now, I mean, this is a prevailing trend. There are all sorts of exceptions to that. There are, you know, there are subgroups within certain of these religious identities who are very exclusive about, you know, the truth of their own tradition and the falsity of their of others. But mostly that translates as, well, this is the best religion for me. I'm not going to say it's got necessarily the best religion for everybody else. But as I say, there's not everybody who talks like that. But it's mostly this kind of ironic, peaceful, tolerant orientation which welcomes the other, the religiously other. The question of, we always ask them, you know, is there such a thing as a bad religion, right? And the prevailing answer is one you kind of almost expect given what I just said. And it says, there's no such thing as a bad religion. There's people who misuse it and do it badly. And they're a problem, right? That goes along with the rejection of militancy that I found virtually across the board. So the otherness has, there's the good other. And then there, if you want to look at, you know, the evil, we did also ask them the big problems of the world and things like that, and you know, there was absolutely no question about the recognition that the world has big problems, but they weren't localized into the same categories of difference as the ones that were structuring the interviews. They were, you know, what you'd expect, you know, peace, intolerance, ecological problems. Sometimes spiritual, moral, and things like that, but not localized in the sense of they're the problem, yeah. Right? And very little of us versus them. Sure, you meet a couple of people who are, you know, they're not afraid to say it, but you realize they're into the whole conspiracy theory game. But I think that sort of comes with the age. There's people in the early 20s who are gung-ho into this, right?
Yeah.
Some of my relatives were at one time too, so that in itself is, but the categories that we were examining were not the ones that were used to morally divide the world.
I think I've got at least three questions that I wanted to spring off that, and we are coming close to time. I think the one most relevant would be, since we were at this Atheist Identities workshop, is this attitude the same amongst people who aren't religious? Because I get the feeling that maybe amongst religious youth, it's, you know, yeah, religion's great. But do the non-religious, do they construct religion as an evil other, or is that not?
Sometimes it's a problematic other.
Yeah.
You do get occasionally, not just from the non-religious, from the spiritually religious too, right? Because that category works quite well with a lot of them. Is that I lost my train of thought here. The repeat your question. It'll come back. You can edit it later.
We can indeed. Do we find that this same tolerance of difference amongst the non-religious towards the religious, or is there a sort of construction of the religious as an other group?
Yeah, sometimes with both the spiritual but not religious, and with some of the people who identify themselves as atheists, they see religion as a problem. All it's ever been good for is to fight wars, that kind of answer. But at least as prevalent among those categories of people is, you know, I can see what religion does for other people. I mean, I can't relate to it at all, but it seems to be good for them, provided they don't start, you know, killing people, right? That kind of thing. But there's an accepting attitude on many of them, of the people who call themselves atheists. But the predominant orientation among those people who call themselves atheists is that it's an argument against religion, not against religious people. So, you know, the reason I can't take this and understand it is because it's not scientific, you know. the standard kinds of arguments you would get among many atheists. I think we made the distinction between the scientific types, and then there were the kind of the Freudian,
More sort of humanistic
types, right?
Social scientific types.
And you get both those kinds. But there isn't a sense of religion being the problem so much as, what is that? Right? I don't understand this. You know, why are people religious? That's silly. That kind of thing.
Hmm.
Is silliness evil? I don't think so, right? It's maybe somewhat incomprehensible for those who can't understand it. And then you get all the people, a lot of people say, it's a Weberian tone deafness, right? I don't know what this is about, I was sitting there in Kana or in synagogue or in church or temple and listening to these people talking, I said, this is ridiculous, right? It's not that they're ridiculous as opposed to bad.
Yeah.
And that's more the orientation that goes alongside with those who were suspicious of religion as such. But even the people who are suspicious of religion very often would use something like the religion-spirituality distinction that spiritual but not religious people use as well to say, religion is the problem, but it's this authoritative thing, right, where you tell people what to do with their bodies and stuff like that, not this, getting in touch with with the transcendent world and with your inner self and all that kind of stuff. That's fine.
Right? Wonderful. I've got two more. I think we've got a couple of minutes before it'll hit 11 o'clock. These are both more relating back to the study of religion. First one would be, is there a sense that scholarship into religion, religious studies, producing sort of volumes on world religions and all that, is there a sense of that feeding back into how, these young people, how people in general in a globalized world are constructing their worldviews? Could you see maybe like the sort of stereotypical religion that we have in the textbooks, is that informing the way people are?
I think it's still one of the informative factors. It's by no means the only one. That if you construct a world religion textbook, the chapter on things that don't quite fit is getting larger and larger.
Yeah.
That chapter was always there. But there's a lot of stuff that fits less and less, and that's even among the people who identify with the delimited traditions. Christians who don't do things that are just Christian, Muslims who don't do things that are just Muslim, etc. But the categorization of the religions and the conviction that they are actually a reality, that seems to me to be, at least as this research would show it, fairly strong. There seems no questioning of that. In other words, there can be questioning about religion as whether that's something legitimate and good, something for me. But when you ask such people, what do you mean by religion? They say, well, like Islam and Christianity, Hinduism and things like that. Those things are clearly there defining the religious field. But there's much else that corresponds that's also relevant. So it's sort of like the nation state's no longer the only model out there for creating collective identities, right? In the contemporary world, it may not even be the dominant model anymore. And so it may be with the religions. They're still very much with us. Absolutely no question about that. But perhaps increasingly they're not the only thing that's going on. But that brings me back to my post-Westphalian thesis, where I talk about not the old thing about change of form. The world religions do not have to maintain the same forms for identifying themselves that they have been developing over the past few hundred years. We may be going in some interesting and new directions, which, for instance, we'll find no problem whatsoever with a Catholic practicing Buddhist meditation or Taoist Tai Chi, whatever.
And finally, in the light of this whole discussion, one of our big projects at the moment is to ask people about, if not world religions, what else? So thinking about like how you, particularly teaching in a university context, in the light of all of this discussion about globalization, is there a better way that we could be sort of constructing like undergraduate curricula instead of around sort of world religions and this sort of thing. Is there another better way that we could be approaching?
Well, in the department I'm part of, we don't do that.
What? Right. Well, wonderful.
we have the world religions courses, of course, and they're core courses. And at, in the upper undergraduate level, we have courses in single traditions, but they're not even offered with any kind of regularity. We put so little emphasis on it. The staff is not hired according to, you know, what religion are you a specialist in, right? We don't have an Islam expert and a Judaism expert and, you know, the et cetera, et cetera. We have people who know quite a bit about some of these religions, but that's not why they're here. They're here, frankly, for their methodological specialization. So our approach, and I think it's a very valid approach, is to take sociological, anthropological, psychological, philosophical, historical approaches to religion, methodological ones, disciplinary ones, and then only after that decide what religious content informs these courses. Yeah. And that's the way we've been doing it, and it's a model so that fits very comfortably with me. I teach no course that has the name of a religion in it.
Wow.
But the words social and society are there all the time.
All the time.
Because that's my methodological specialization. I'm a sociologist.
Well, I get the feeling that we could go on talking all day, but for the benefit of the listeners and for the benefit of your schedule and mine, we'll have to close there. But thank you so much for speaking to me.
Well, thank you.
Well, that was Chris talking to Peter Baird there. Peter Baird, who literally wrote the book on religion and globalization.
Did he?
Literally.
I didn't
know. The book's called that. Next week, I'm actually doing an interview for, I think, the first time this year.
Sorry, can you say that again?
That I'm doing the interview. Yes, me, David Robertson, I'm doing an interview.
That's very impressive, David. Yeah. I mean, good. Some of us haven't done an interview this year.
And I'm very pleased to be... I've done it already, but I'm pleased to be letting you hear my interview. It's the first time we've invited somebody back, and we've invited Jim Cox back. He spoke last time about phenomenology.
Phenomenology.
Jonathan is grinning just at the sound of the word. Jonathan, of course, wrote the response to Jim's podcast, and both Jonathan's response and Jim's podcast have been massive hits, with Jim's being, I think, over 1,600 listens now, which is, I think you'll agree, quite something. So we've invited him back anyway, and this time he's going to talk about the world religions paradigm. And I should point out that Jim Cox literally wrote the book on From Primitive to Indigenous.
Actually, I think he wrote the book on phenomenology, rather. Yeah.
Yeah.
He
literally wrote the book on An Introduction to Phenomenology.
And A Guide to Phenomenology.
Indeed.
And key figures in
phenomenology.
With a theme.
As always, you can download our podcasts on iTunes. If you do so, please leave a rating. We greatly appreciate that. It helps us get the message out. You can subscribe to us through Facebook if you like us. You'll get links to our weekly podcasts, our weekly responses, and our weekly opportunities digest. And that's where a lot of discussion happens. You can leave comments on the website, www.religiousstudiesproject.com. You can find us on Twitter at Project RS. If you are buying books, you can do so through our Amazon affiliates, which will provide us with a little bit of income, which will help us to continue to provide you with these stimulating podcasts without annoying adverts stuck in the middle of it. But other than that, all that remains to be said is, Jonathan,
thanks for listening.